So if you're anything like me, you do a lot of your online shopping, well, a lot of your shopping at all, on Amazon. So if this is a case for you, and you're looking to buy something anyway, if you go to our website at tensandaces.com, near the top of the page, you will see an Amazon banner ad. If you click there, prior to making a purchase on Amazon, it will open up your Amazon app just like normal, or if you're in a browser, go to the Amazon webpage just like it would normally if you were to type in amazon.com. The only thing that's different is that because you click through our referral link, the Tens and Aces podcast will get a small little commission on whatever you buy. It doesn't cost you anything. It's just a good way to support the show and show your love for TNA and, you know, help cover some of the cost that it costs to make this thing. So remember, if you're going to buy something on Amazon anyway, go to tensandaces.com, click the Amazon banner, and then you're good to go. And you're helping out something you like this podcast. And it's a win-win, win-win-win-win-win. Oh, and why I got you here, thank you all for listening. We really appreciate it. Now, enjoy the show.
What's your name?
Well, my name is Jim, but most people call me Jim.
Okay, Jim, since you are my guest and I am your host, what are your pleasures? What do you like to do?
Oh, I don't know. Play chess? Screw.
Well, let's play chess.
For all of your TNA needs, head to tensandaces.com.
Are you serious about becoming a Blackjack Advantage player? If that's your plan, then listen to the real pros first. They will tell you to test out and hone your skills before risking your starting bankroll. Check out the Advantage Player Refinement Program, offered exclusively by Archimedes21.com. The A21 APRP will tell you if you're ready. Until then, look into becoming an investor in Archimedes 21 and start earning right away.
One of these losers in Las Vegas who keeps thinking he's going to come up with a way to win at blackjack.
Are you ready for some TNA?
Welcome to TNA, the Tens and Aces podcast, a podcast with true-to-life stories and experiences from advantaged players in the game of blackjack. From pros crushing it and making a living counting cards, to newer players who are just making their way through all the ups and downs of what can be, at times, both an equally frustrating and beautiful game of AP Blackjack. Is this the kind of thing you want to hear? Well, listen up, because we're about to give you some TNA. Here's your host, Mike AP.
And welcome to the show today. As the man just said, I'm your host of this transmission of our experiment in imaginary radio that we like to call TNA, the Tens and Aces podcast. So if this is the kind of thing you want to hear, well, listen up, because we're about to give you some TNA.
And welcome to the show today. Today I have Waco Kid with me, but before we get to the interview, I just want to apologize for the kind of crappy audio on my end on this episode. My voice is over-modulated and clipping and distorted at points because I had my mic set up wrong during this interview, so I just want to apologize for that. There's lots of good stuff in this interview, so I didn't want to scrap it. But anyway, please forgive me and keep that in mind when you hear this interview. So how's it going, man?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm good. So, man, just to give the listeners a little bit of a better idea of who you are and what your AP experience is, how about a little thumbnail sketch origin story?
I've been playing blackjack for about 5 years, but my story with gambling goes back a lot further. I actually got into playing blackjack through poker. I started playing poker back in 2002, 2003, just as the World Poker Tour was starting to air shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was getting in kind of in the heyday of online poker, and I was pretty young at the time. I wasn't technically allowed to play online. But my friends and I, you know, pooled some money and deposited onto party poker. You know, I remember my parents told me, oh, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. You're wasting your money or whatever. I worked as a cashier at the time and $40 or $50 a week. And so one week I took 25 of that and I put it online with my friend. So we deposited $50. And about 2 weeks later, we won a multi-table tournament for $3,000. And so when I got, you know, the $1,000 check from that, that was when my dad said, oh, okay, maybe it's not a waste of time after all. You know, my parents were always a little reticent about letting me do it too often. So, you know, I always had that constant pressure from them, study and stay in school and all of that jazz.
Sure.
But yeah, so I was playing poker on party poker back then. We were doing pretty well, making money. A lot of my friends that I got into poker with, we would, you know, we would sweat each other on big tournaments. You know, I graduated high school. I went to college. I kept playing poker all through college. I was making probably, I don't know, $1,000 or $1,500 a semester playing poker with people on campus, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but really that's like all the spending money you need for a semester. Yeah.
That's beer money.
And it's also, the amazing part is we played strictly $20 buy-in. So the fact that I was making all that money each semester off $20 buy-in game, pretty incredible. You know, it was probably me and two other guys that did most of the winning, or several donators.
Right. You know, that is pretty impressive, especially if you're Fish or other broke college kids. You know, there's only so much money there to take, right?
Right. Yeah. The pool was kind of slim. We had to, we introduced several people to poker that they had a brief foray before abandoning it.
You guys suck.
Yeah, so I did that all through college. You know, towards the end of college, I was playing a lot on Full Tilt. This was around 2009. And so I had it in my head when I graduated that I was going to try to play poker full time. And so I moved back to my parents' house after college for about 3 months. And then I had my bankroll and I said, you know what, I'm going to move into this place with my friend and try to play poker full time. So I did that for about 6 months, and I did reasonably okay. But the thing was, at the end of that 6 months, I realized that, like, the quality of life there, you know, it's stressful to play a game like that for a living, where you have to worry about paying your bills every month. Like, for me, I felt like I was constantly in go mode. Like, I had to play 12 hours a day, or I wasn't doing the most that I could to succeed, you know. So even going out to drink with friends, I had a hard time just relaxing and having fun, because I felt like, oh, I should be working right now. And so ultimately I decided to abandon that and go to grad school in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept playing poker all through grad school. You know, I was grinding mid-stakes cash games on Full Tilt. Then Black Friday happened.
Yeah.
You know, anybody in the poker world, that was a major event. You know, my whole bankroll got locked up.
And yeah.
I remember what happened that weekend. I was playing on Full Tilt that Friday. I grinded out a session that morning, and then I had to go to a class. But I left my Full Tilt client. And so I got back from class, right? And I had all these messages waiting for my friends. They're like, dude, go to the Full Tilt website. The FBI had seized the domain and put up like a really big intimidating banner. And
yeah.
Like, what's
yeah.
going on? But, you know, so through all of this, I was still logged. And I learned through the grapevine that you only got locked out once you closed out of it. So I ended up playing all of that again, and well into the next week. I played for probably almost 7 days after Black Friday, just because I never logged out.
Screw the FBI.
yeah. So, you know, the number of U.S. players I was seeing on the table was shrinking day by day. I was playing exclusively against people in Europe and stuff by the following week. Eventually, you know, they like a forced system reboot or whatever, where it logged everyone out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what ultimately locked me out. But, you know, so I lost my bankroll from that, and I didn't end up getting that money back until 2015, so it took over wow. 4 years.
It's my money, and I need it now!
Of course, those of us in the AP world know what Black Friday is, but there might be newer listeners here, newer to the AP world anyway, who just don't know what it is. So could you maybe explain that real quick?
Sure, yeah. So really, I guess it started with, in 2006, they passed the UIGEA, I believe it is, on Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act. And this basically made it illegal for online casinos to process payments. So, you know, the big thing back then, the way people managed their money mostly was with NetTeller. It was easy to move money around between the sites and cash out. And NetTeller took a big hit when the UIGEA happened. So since it made it illegal for all these sites to process payments, several of them went down back then. I know Party Poker took a hit. I think they clearly stuck around.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, you know, the sites that continued to operate after that were really in a legal gray area. And so in the post-UIGEA world, Full Tilt and PokerStars really emerged as the top poker sites to play on. But they were in this legal gray area, and they were making a lot of money. You know, whenever someone's making a lot of money, the government wants to look into that and get their cut, right? So eventually, when Black Friday happened, it was the FBI cracking down on these big poker sites. They hit PokerStars, Full Tilt, and there was a third one. I think it might have been Ultimate Bet or something. They hit all of them at once and basically said, you're no longer allowed to do business with U.S. customers. And there were a lot of people that were playing on those sites to make money or to make a living. So it really hit the poker community hard. Because back then it was common to have, you know, 50 or 80% of your bankroll online, you only kept a small amount to play live games. So it really hit everyone hard.
I bet.
Black Friday was an apt name for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a dark day in poker history. I think, you know, anybody that was playing back then has their own little story about how it affected.
Yeah, and you can see the after effects as poker slowly died and poker rooms closed, you know, little bit by little bit as the interest waned in poker, in live poker, because of the poker boom was over and part of it was killed by that action right there.
Yeah, and you know, the post-Black Friday world, it was, you know, you had two camps of people. You had people that were gung-ho about playing online, and these were the people that were making enough money and it was their full-time job, where they decided they're moving to Canada or Mexico to keep going. Obviously that takes quite a bit of dedication. But the other camp of people were the people that tried to transition into being live pro. And I can tell you, like, when you get used to playing 16 tables of cash games online and you're playing 1,000 hands an hour, it's tough to switch to in person where you're getting 30 hands an hour. It's just a different game. And so a lot of people wanted to make the switch and they struggled with it. And I was one of those, you know, I had been grinding out probably, you know, 50, 60,000 hands a month online. And I didn't really, you know, the closest casino to me was about 2 hours away. And I was really only doing it for supplemental income anyway. So I ended up taking a long break from poker after Black Friday. But so I ended up finishing my graduate degree. I got a master's degree in physics. Then I applied to a bunch of jobs. I was lucky enough to get one. And so I kind of had a quiet period where I wasn't playing much poker or anything for several years. But I think the quietness of that eventually got. So in 2016, you know, I made this, I thought it was kind of a joke with some of my friends, but I made this New Year's resolution that I was going to drink more and gamble more.
Because, did you succeed? You know,
I succeeded in the gambling more, but the drinking still is just not for me.
Yeah, especially while gambling.
yeah, you know, towards that New Year's goal, you know, I went out and decided to play some live poker early in 2016. It might have been like January 3rd or 4th. But I went to play. I played all day for like 14 hours, and I had grinded out a nice profit. But by the end of the day, you know, there came a pot where I flopped a set and got it in against somebody that had a higher set. For people that don't know poker terminology, that's three of a kind. It's usually, when it's a very strong hand, you're usually likely to double up when you get one of those. But, you know, so I got stacked. And so at the end of this 14 hours, I've been grinding all day and I broke, you know, I was just kind of disappointed. So I'm wandering upstairs and I still had money in my pocket. And I was like, I don't want to play any more poker. I don't want to go home right now. What can I do? And there's blackjack pits upstairs. And so literally while I'm walking upstairs, saying to myself, oh, well, you know, I saw the movie 21. I know you count the twos through sixes as a one, sevens, eights, nines are zero, and then the face cards and aces are minus one. So I'll just go do that for a little while and, you know, see what happens. So I sat down at this table I bought in for $300, and it was a $25 table. And I just start counting. And I actually, even though the only practice I had was telling myself in my head on the way up the stairs, I felt reasonably confident in my running count at the time. I'm sure that it was awful, but, you know, yeah, missing parts of the equation. I didn't know about true count conversion at the time. I didn't know about betting ramps. So I remember distinctly one situation where the shoe was about halfway done. I had a running count of 23, and I'm looking at the cards and I'm thinking, well, 23 is pretty high. I definitely have an advantage here. How much should I bet? And I looked down, I had about $600 in green chip, and I was like, I really don't know what to bet. So I just put them all in one pile and bet everything.
Oh, shit. Did you win?
And luckily, I got a blackjack that hand.
Wow, that confirmed your bias that you were giving yourself right there.
Yeah. And so, you know, I got a nice payoff from that. But then, you know, the next hand, I think I bet 375 and lost. And then the next hand, I had a difficult to play hand. It was like a pair of threes against an eight or something, where if you don't know basic strategy really well, it's easy to make mistakes. And I'm pretty sure I lit the threes or something with a lot of money out there. So all said and done, like, I did pretty good that initial session. I might have won like $1,500 or something. But more than any, like, you know, I knew that I had gotten lucky, and I really went home and I decided, you know what, I want to read a book about this and get better at it. There's clearly things I don't know. I need to brush up and like learn more. And so I looked up a card counting book, which there's a lot of them out there. I didn't know who the reputable authors were or anything. So, I found this book called Modern Card Counting. And that was the first book that I read. And I would say that book has a lot of good information in it. The one thing that it doesn't have is a good count to use. So the count that's recommended in that book is an unbalanced level 2 Zen count.
For a beginner.
For a beginner, yeah. It's just awful to use. So I spent like a week practicing this unbalanced Zen. And I went back to the casino the following week. And I tried to play it at the table. And within about 30 minutes, I was like, this is absolutely ridiculous. There's no way that this is going to be the way to do it. And I know that this count is different than high-low. So I need to just learn more about high-low side.
Yeah, and you learn the running count walking up the stairs. So,
yeah, exactly.
Or at least some level of it.
I'm kind of surprised. I mean, you know, at the time I didn't know there were different counts, so I just expected every book told you about high-low, you know, so I was surprised that it told me a different one to begin with. But so I started looking more into high-low. And I tried to use it. Honestly, I struggled with the true count conversions at first. I wasn't good at estimating the decks. And so as I'm researching high-low, I found out about KO. And that's when I ordered Vankura's book, Knockout Blackjack. So I ended up taking about a month to practice KO and get it down pat. Mm-hmm. And that ended up being my system of choice for a long time after.
Because of the true count conversion difficulties.
I just found it easier to just keep the running count and do it that way. And I liked that, you know, all the deviations were... I made plenty of money. I probably put it in a couple hundred hours before I even used any deviations. I was just purely betting based on the running count until I get up to my pivot point where I had a max bet. And I made plenty of money just doing it that way. So eventually, when that became second nature, I started adding the deviations in. And again, I continued with it like that for a while. And eventually, you know, you just get to a point where you want to keep improving, right? And so I became aware that in KO, you know, it doesn't tell you about those times early in the shoe when the true count goes up to like a 1 or 2, where you can actually put out some extra bets. And so that really annoyed me. I was like, I want something more precise, you know, so I looked into doing true counted KO, where you're essentially keeping a KO running count, but then you're doing some complicated math to convert it to a high low. So you're subtracting off 4 times the number of decks to account for the 7s that you're counting, and then dividing by the number of decks remaining, which is really like just a needlessly complicated version of high low.
Yeah.
And so I only did that for a very short period of time before I was like, okay, I think I'm just going to do high low. I feel better about my deck conversions, and I'm going to stick with high low. And so probably after about a year, I switched to using high low at the tables.
Right. Yeah. The unbalanced count will lead to underestimating possibly in the beginning and overestimating
and overbetting at the end of the shoe.
The reason is so early on, like, well, I could use some numbers, but I'll probably mess it up. But really, like, you know, if it goes up to like a true 1 or 2 early in the shoe, you're just based on your KO running count, you're usually not going to be raising your bets at that point. Whereas if you were using high-low or a true counted system, you would be aware of those situations and be increasing your bets slightly.
Right.
And then at the end of the shoe, when the count is right near the pivot point, but not quite there yet, like really, you know, in KO, the pivot point corresponds to a true count of 4. So whenever you have you're at your pivot point, you know the true count is 4. But when you're below that, it could vary. And towards the end of the shoe, you might be putting out a pretty big bet when the true count is only 1, you know, because you're just below your pivot point. And so, you know, those slight deficiencies kind of bothered me. And that's what led to me switching.
Now's a good time to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, this is Colin from BlackjackApprenticeship.com, and if you're serious about card counting, I'd encourage you to check out the Blackjack Apprenticeship membership. It has the training tools you'll need to beat the game, like our comprehensive video course and our training suite, so you can learn each skill and virtually test yourself before ever stepping foot in a casino. It also includes the tools you'll need to succeed, like our pro betting software, casino database, results tracking software, and access to a community of like-minded advantage players to network with in our members forum and chat room software. You can find out more at blackjackapprenticeship.com.
What is Budweiser? It's bright, the look of perfection. It's crisp, with ideal flavor. It's clean, for a great finish. It's pure, made with the finest all-natural ingredients. It's the smooth, flavorful result of beechwood aging. Bright, crisp, clean, pure. This is Budweiser. This is beer.
If you'd like to reach out to the show, you can reach us on our website at tensanesis.com. You can text us or leave us a voicemail at area code 518-289-0478. That's 518-289-0478. And if you still haven't gotten enough TNA, you can email us at tensandaces21@gmail.com. That's tensandaces21@gmail.com.
Just for clarity's sake, and for the listener's benefit, the inefficiencies in your KO count that you were using differs from the floating advantage. You want to take a stab at trying to explain the difference between the inefficiencies of the count you were using as you were explaining versus the floating advantage?
Floating advantage, there's actually a good chapter in Blackjack Attack 3 by Don Schlesinger about that. And that's basically this kind of mysterious concept that a true count of 3 towards the end of a shoe is worth slightly more than a true count of 3 at the beginning of a shoe.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a lot of simulations to try to figure out exactly why that is. I guess the way that I've to reckon with the floating advantage concept is towards the end of the shoe. Like if the penetration was 100%, you always got to see all the cards that came out.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, at the end of the shoe, you're always guaranteed to see all the extra 10s that counted. You're going to see them. They're going to be dealt. Whereas in the beginning of the shoe, there's more variability in the way that true count can present itself. It could present itself slowly over the course of the rest of the shoe. There could be one packet of cards that comes out and everybody on the table gets a 20 and now you're back at 0.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I guess that was the way that I've thought of the floating advantages. Just that at the end of the shoe, you're more likely to see a 10 dealt right now. And there is less variability in that outcome.
Right. But yeah, that's a good way to explain it.
And so yeah, I switched to high-low after about a year, and I had already probably made, 20 or 25 grand just using KO. So I had enjoyed some decent success that first year, and I loved going to play. And I started playing more poker around that time, too, and I really liked kind of the interplay of poker and blackjack, which is to say, you know, when you play blackjack, you're rewarded for making robotic decisions and playing perfectly. Whereas when you're at the poker table in a cash game setting, you know, you really have to pay attention to people and you're allowed to make more subjective decisions. You bring your toolbox of math to the table and your prior knowledge of ranges and everything. But at the end of the day, you have to figure out the people you're playing with to really exploit them.
Right.
And so it's just using different parts of your brain. And I've found really, you know, if I go through a period of playing a lot of blackjack, it's more enjoyable to play poker for a weekend and vice versa. They just use different parts of your brain. So I like switching between the two.
Yeah, I find live poker in the casino very, 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 very boring. But I could definitely see what you're saying there about if you've been playing a lot of blackjack and you go and, you know, play poker for a weekend, it would be much less of a grind.
Yeah, it's and you know,
or vice versa.
I agree with you. Live poker is inherently boring. It's a waiting. But the thing is, when you've been playing a lot of blackjack hours, just like constant adrenaline and you know, lots of money on the line and stuff, you almost look forward to taking it easy for a bit at the poker table, you know. And then, you know, so it's a cycle that feeds on itself. Spend some time at the poker table. Now you're tired of waiting for good situations again, so you go play some blackjack.
I've seen many a poker player come to at a casino that has both poker rooms and table games. I've seen many a poker player come with like a couple $100 or $100 trying to win a buy-in for the poker table on the blackjack table. Just terrible blackjack players.
Yeah.
Just really impatient. Yeah. Hit one big hit, walk off, leave.
Yeah, and there's, you know, that really gets to the whole idea of money management and gambling. Like I've seen a lot of very good poker players that they blow all of their winnings in the pits or at slot machines, and they just feel justified in doing it because they feel like, oh, you know, I can always grind out another win tomorrow. But you know, they're really just gamblers, and they're using their skills at poker to feed their gambling. A lot of people that do that don't look at it that way, but I see it for what it is.
You look at it like it's free money.
Slot hustlers too. Yeah, you see a lot of slot hustlers. They'll spend all day walking around collecting money and they go blow it on Baccarat. or something. So there's APs out there that aren't really APs because they don't keep any of the money they make.
Right. That's the key, right? So
yep. You're at the blackjack table. You got to adopt all of the ploppy methodology that benefit you and none of the ones that don't.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you're back counting a shoe and you sit down and somebody says, oh, do you mind waiting till the end of the shoe? You just say, oh, no, I'm going to play right now. We're in this together, man. And you just throw your bets out. And then when you're in the opposite situation and you're betting into a rich deck and someone goes to sit down, then you ask them to wait till the end of the shoe.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Both ways.
Yeah. Anytime I walk up to the table and, of course, the people don't know who I am and they say what you just said about, hey, can you wait? I immediately start counting from that point and see if their bets move in the right direction relative to what I see happen on the table right there. And just to see, and sometimes I won't even sit down. And sometimes I go like, that's this guy's table. It's pretty clear what he's doing.
Yeah. And another popular one, you know, this is the sacred flow of the cards.
You
can use to your benefit as well. So, you know, if you have to make a deviation play and you just know based on the people at the table that everybody's going to think you're out of your mind. Oh, I had to change the flow of the cards. You know, you got to pull that thing out whenever it will benefit you and mention it. Because as soon as you bring that up, everyone's like, oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Excluding the dealer.
It's like a magic bullet for anything weird you might do. Oh, I'm just, you know, I had to fix the flow of the card.
My friend, the snowman, has a name for that. It's a little racist, but whatever. He calls it advanced Asian card flow theory. Because it's usually an older Asian lady who's the one who's piping up about how important the number of players at the table is or the card flow. So sometimes he'll be sitting there and he's like, how's it going? And he goes, well, there's a lot of AACT going on.
Yeah. You know, I can relate to that because there's some casinos I've played at where there's a lot of Asian gamblers. And, you know, sometimes if you're betting into a rich shoe, you want to get, or even maybe the pack isn't even rich yet, but you just want to be playing heads up as often as possible. So if you have people on the table that ascribe to this concept, you know, the most effective method I've found to get them off the table is to start playing every other hand. So you play a hand and then you sit out and then you play a hand and then you sit out. And this drives them absolutely bananas. They will like pick up their money and leave so quick. They'll scoff at you. They'll say, what are you doing? You know, it works really well.
Most of the time I've had it where I did that intentionally, just like you're talking about. Coincidentally, of course, we know this. The guy won every hand. And then it worked out. So he liked me. Yeah. I used to play Baccarat to take advantage of some massive free play. Of course, I don't bet the Chinese method because they look for patterns and all this stuff. And most of the players at the casino I was playing at that are playing Baccarat almost exclusively were Chinese players. This guy, he's betting like table max times two spots plus all the money on the sucker bets. And I was betting like $50 to play these match play coupons or free play, whatever it was. I don't remember. It's the only reason I was there. It was no commission Baccarat. I was the best spot to play these coupons. He's like, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $50 every time you don't play until I lose a hand. And he won six in a row. He was happy. He was very happy. And I won free money for doing nothing with no risk.
That's insane.
It was pretty great. But to him, it worked, right? So I was like, you got a deal, dude.
Yeah, you know, that's part of casino comportment, you know, is like once you feel comfortable being in a casino and you take in the environment, you got to kind of go with the flow and just keep your eye out for these opportunities to, you know, if you're just friendly with people, you'll be surprised number of times something like that will happen.
Yeah.
We'll start offering you to
buy their double
or put up their insurance. I've bought insurance for the whole table multiple times. You know, it's a great, whenever you can do that, it's great because it pays 2-1 and you have a huge edge when you're actually putting that bet out. So if you can buy insurance for the whole table and keep all the winnings, it's awesome.
Yeah. And also because everybody thinks, including most dealers and some floors who aren't keen to what we're doing as much as other, that you look like a total gambler just trying to get bets out there. Like
you look insane.
Yeah. Right. So if you play it off right, you look like, well, this guy's really got a problem. He just needs another drink. You know, he needs a fix. So he sees a spot to bet on, you know.
Yeah.
So
you got to just, you know, be friendly to people and let the advantages come to you sometimes, not try to force
them. Yeah, I think in life in general, if you just do the right thing, like, you know, golden rule, act like you want others to treat you, things will work out. And call it karma or call it whatever. It's definitely, I think to kind of dovetail your point, though, I know when I first started doing this, I would walk in a casino, walk straight to the blackjack table. I wouldn't look around at any other opportunities. Plus one that looks very suspicious, that you park and you go straight straight, like you're going, like you're clocking in going to work. That's not good. But right, you miss so many other opportunities. Like I didn't, at first, I didn't really know what, I knew what, there was hole carding, but I didn't know what it looked like. And once you see your first hole, it's like you can't not see them anymore. It's like when you buy like a, say you buy a Ford Ranger, a green one, and then all of a sudden on the road, there's like a ton of Ford Rangers, green Ford Rangers, right? It's just your brain. You just cannot not see it. Same kind of concept, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway,
yeah,
I'm getting sidetracked here. So when she switched to blackjack, or not switched, but got serious about blackjack, where does your game go from there?
Yeah, so I kept playing by myself, but it had been about a year and a half of me putting in hours, and I probably had about 700 hours at that point. And I'm working full time this whole time, mind you. Like, I was playing on weekends, weeknights. I was getting in hours whenever I could, going on trips and everything. I was playing a lot. So, you know, if you consider full time work's about 2,000 hours a year, and then I did about 500 hours of blackjack on top of that. I was kind of tired all the time, but I enjoyed the whole grind, you know. And it got to the point where I felt like I had stretched what I could do on my own to the max, and I really wanted to branch out and network and find a team. You know, I decided, you know, team play is really the way to go, because the math, when you look at the math for playing on a team versus playing solo, it's just unquestionably better.
On all angles, from variance to maximizing your time, because, you know, you're playing with a higher bankroll, and it's just, yeah, agreed.
Yeah, it's really just the best way to go. The only caveat is you need to do it with people that you trust, you know, that's the hard part. And so you can't just find somebody that wants to team up and go with them. You got to kind of vet people a little bit, get a handle for, you know, who is this person? How do they handle themselves? Are they the type of person that's just going to take money when they have the opportunity? And, you know, you got to kind of get a feel for people before you decide to team up.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think everybody having investment and skin in the game, not just a wage, is key too. Because if you're, right, then they're ripping themselves off too. And that's way less likely to have somebody to skim if they're skimming their own money too, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, everybody's got to have skin in the game, and you got to have this collective sense of working towards a common goal, whatever that goal is, monetary goal or the number of hours or, you know, what have you.
Yeah.
So I started trying to network with people, and I met a couple people, and I got into this Northeast Chord. We had just a couple people in it back then, and we started just inviting, you know, people that we met while we were out playing that we thought were good people. So it expanded slowly at first. You know, we got up to 8 members, 10 members, and a lot of people would join, and then they wouldn't really post anything, and they would just sit there silent for a long time. So eventually the guy that moderated that, he kind of wasn't playing much blackjack anymore, so he handed the moderation on me. And we just kept rolling, you know. We added a private chat for people that, like, trusted members. So, you know, compared to the public Discord, this one has multiple layers. You have to get invited in the first place, and then in order to have access to, like, the members-only section, that means that you've probably, like, met up with someone in real life, or you're, like, vouched for in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's because it's also geographically specific to the Northeast, and it's really great because, you know, we probably have 40 or 50 members now, but pretty much anywhere in the Northeast, if you're planning a trip, you can send a message, and probably somebody in the group has been in that area recently, give you the latest on what's going on, whether there's promotions, you know, how mm-hmm. are they taking action, what's the penetration like. It's really, you know, good info to have for when you're going to play.
So, yeah, definitely, for sure.
So I started, you know, networking with people on there, and can't remember the order of things, but I think later in that year, I joined that one. I joined Rymo's Discord, 2017, 2018 timeframe. And yeah, so I teamed up with, at first I just had a partner. So him and I would go on weekend trips, and we would put up equal amounts of money, and we would play all weekend long. He wasn't the best at counting. I was teaching him how to count. He would take signals from me at the table, and we would do a balanced betting strategy. So we knew, like, for the amount of money we had, how much we wanted to bet at certain true counts. And so if I put out big bets, his would be smaller. And if he put out bigger bets, mine would be smaller. We would compensate for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a lot of great weekend trips doing that. There were some weekends where we turned 10,000 into 25,000 and stuff. And, mind you, you know, we're playing replenishable bankroll style. So even though we have 10,000, we're not betting like if the 10,000 was lost, then we're ruined. We're betting like the 10,000 needs to support 20 hours of play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, you know, we went to a couple casino opening weekends together, which I would say, you know, for anyone out there that's never been to the opening weekend of casino, it's like an AP circus, and it's the best yep. thing that you'll ever do.
That or AVN weekend in Vegas, you know, the porn convention, and, you know, yeah, for obvious reasons, pit bosses are distracted, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, casino opening weekends, they have this fleet of new employees that don't really know what the hell they're doing. And, you know, usually you can make money on opening weekend without even counting. And in fact, counting is probably should be the last thing on your list.
Yeah, especially in new, maybe this applies in Vegas too, but in markets that they're new markets that don't really have much casino experience. So the finding people right. to work there, you're going to get a bunch of green people. There's a casino that opened in the Northwest 3-4 years ago, and it was dealer errors galore. And of course, yeah, you know, you point out exactly. the ones in your favor. Yeah. And it's been open like 3 years. And it's actually managed by Mohegan Sun, but it's still, because it was in an area of the state that didn't have hardly any casinos. There's still a lot of poor dealers there. They make a lot of mistakes, even like cashiers that at the cage that pay out wrong often. Of course, you got to watch them there because they could screw up in either direction. But, you know, yeah. So yeah,
you know, if Atlantic City opens a new casino, they're going to be hiring from an employee pool of people that have been in business for 30, 40 years, probably. Mm-hmm. And if a casino opens up in the middle of nowhere, now you got, you know, some guy named John, and he's like, last week I drove a truck, and now I'm a pit boss. So
yeah.
It's a whole different game, you know, and you'll find dealers that are making like 14 hours an hour, where you don't even need to vary your bet with the count. You just flat bet, and you take the money.
Yeah, I had this dealer at this, when that new place was maybe, that I just mentioned, was open maybe 3-4 months, and he backed his own hand up into a blackjack, and you know, you're not supposed to back cards up. He backed cards up into a blackjack and took everybody's money, and I asked him, you can back up cards here? He looked at me like I was speaking Greek and didn't know what I was talking about. And then a floor walked by that I had recognized from the other casino, like 2 hours away. Yeah, she moved to that place. I said, hey, do you guys back up cards? She's like, no. I said, well, he did 2 hands ago. And then, you know, they did a review, and like, I don't know, half an hour later, they came by and gave everybody their money back for that hand. And he's like, well, his excuse was that he's normally on the dice table. And I kid you not. I'm like, wow. Like, this isn't his game. It's like, dude, you're a dealer. But yeah.
Yeah. Some of the best dealer errors that I've encountered on opening weekends. One place, the dealer, she didn't follow the shuffling procedure properly. So, you know,
awesome.
So they did a hand shuffle, and, you know, it was a 2-pass shuffle. So the shuffle itself was fine. But then, you know, they pick the cards up, they knock them against the shoe to even them out, and then they present them to the player to cut.
Sure.
And normally what happens is you put the cut card in, they cut the shoe in half where you inserted, then they take that middle cut card out, and then they reinsert it a deck or two from the back, depending on the penetration. Well, at this place, they would present the shoe to the player, and you would insert the cut card, and then they would pick the cards up and put them right in the shoe.
Yeah.
And so it was pick your own penetration weekend.
That is awesome. Like, they're like, "When I need at least 10 cards, sir." I'm like, okay, I'll give you 11.
So the amazing part to me is, you know, there came a point where I had been doing this, and I'd been cutting off about 20 cards on an 8-deck shoe. So I had, you know, 97% penetration. The pit boss comes up and she says to the dealer, like, hey, I just got a call from upstairs. It looks like you made a procedure error. So next time you shuffle, call me over and I'll show you how to do it properly. And so I'm thinking to myself, oh, son of a bee. They're onto it. They're going to fix it now. And so the next shuffle comes up, and the dealer calls the pit boss over. She does her shuffle, and she starts to shuffle. She cuts the shoe in half, and she goes to take a half deck grab from each pile and riffle it together. And the pit boss says, no, see, this is your error. And she points to the right hand pile and she says, you need to turn this pile counterclockwise a half turn.
Sure.
Now do your shuffle. And so she does the shuffle, and then she presents the cards to me. I insert the cut card, 20 cards from the back, and she lifts it up and puts it into the shoe. And the pit boss says, okay, good, you're all set.
Wow.
And so even the pit boss, you know, corrected the error of not turning the pile half a turn.
Yeah, to,
that was the only thing she felt needed correcting.
Yeah, you were really going to edge store 8 decks because that's why they turned the card, right? But
right.
That's so awesome.
You know, never underestimate the level of stupidity casino personnel can bring to the table.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite sayings of Richard Munchkin. The crazy thing is they were obviously watching her enough to notice that she didn't do the turn of the cards, but they weren't noticing. You think she would have ran out of cards at some point if somebody had some crazy split with 20 cards cut off. I don't know. It would have been really tempting to go as far as I could, but I might have just went like 3/4 of a deck or something. Or
we cut it close a few times, and I was actually kind of mindful of it, of like, okay, if I spread to like 3 or 4 hands right now, we'll probably run out. There were a couple times where I played one spot instead of two just to make sure we didn't run out of cards.
Yeah, because you didn't want to throw a red flag up there.
Keeping that going is worth more than playing spots.
Oh yeah, that's a gold mine. The only problem is if you get a really shitty shoe, it's going to last a lot longer. 8-deck shoes are just a slog sometimes. So that's when, I guess, when you go to the bathroom.
Right. Yeah, you go to the bathroom and take phone calls at strategic times, for sure.
For sure. Right, that's funny, man.
So another thing you can do with dealers that are new is you can do a ploppy gave me this term, actually. There's a funny story behind it. But even though he was a ploppy, he knew what he was talking about. So he said, you know, watch this. I'm going to blind the dealer with reds. And what he meant is, you know, if you're going to, let's say you're going to put out a big bet because you have a good count and you have a new dealer on the table. Mm-hmm. Well, you're not going to bet $300. You're going to bet, you know, 3 green chips, a whole mess of red, and then like 7 or 8 or 9 pink chips on top of it. And then when you get a blackjack on your $177.50 bet, you're going to watch in glory as the dealer miscalculates and gives you like $500 or $600.
You're right.
They can't do 3 to 2 times 177.50. So, you know, if you just make their job really difficult, and they will mess up and give you more money than they should.
That's great.
And this ploppy that he picked up on that, he started doing it. I saw him get paid multiple times, and the pit would come up and confirm the wrong payout.
Yeah.
So I was like, shit, I'm going to start doing that too.
Yeah, you're right. Because at a new place like that, where everybody's green, especially like you said, in Atlantic City, where they have 40 years of casino workers, that's probably not going to be as powerful as some place in the middle of nowhere, like you were saying. But my point is, the floor and the surveillance and everybody is newer. And maybe the people who are a floor were dealers somewhere else, and they got moved up to floors. Or maybe, yeah, you know, maybe the person who's the boss in surveillance was, you know, just a lower surveillance worker, you know, because they got, you know, they moved up or whatever. I don't know. I'm just saying, everybody's new, and it's the first day. Everybody's rusty, even if they've been doing it a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Systems aren't in place. Yep. They're usually slammed busy. That's the only problem with opening days, is rounds per hour kind of go down. That's probably part of why you said actually card counting is maybe not the best thing to do during those days.
Yeah, unless you're going to play some off-peak hours or something. You know, if you show up at midnight, you probably get some good conditions overnight. But
Right. On a Tuesday or something.
But this, you know, this concept of kind of making Xeno personnel's job difficult is, I think, actually a really valuable concept, because it applies to security, too. You know, like when you're trying to get hours in and stay under the radar, you know, you want to make their job difficult. Put yourself in their shoes. If you're, let's say you show up to work, you go up to your little room, you got a cup of coffee, you got 12 monitors set up, you can click between 500 cameras or whatever. You know, you got people calling you to check on this or that. You got to watch the dealers, make sure they're not stealing. You got a lot going on. And so what in that situation, who's the easiest card counter to catch? It's the guy who's betting the most money in the joint and playing the same table for 6 hours, you know, because you can just like click to that and like, oh, I see what that guy's, you know. So you got to make it difficult. And I think playing short sessions is one of the biggest weapons in the arsenal that not enough people use. Even if you're playing in the same casino, if you're moving between tables, taking little breaks, you know, not staying on over shift breaks, just playing 1 or 2 shoes here, switching tables, playing some over there, if you're moving around a lot, you're making their job a lot more difficult. And, you know, thing Richard Munchkin said on Gambling with an Edge that I think is really valuable is, he said, you know, you can leave the casino, go out to your car, and then come back in. And if you do that multiple times over the course of your play, now you're making it difficult for them to even rewind the tape, because there's multiple times where they're going to think that you just arrived or just left. So even the investigation process is difficult for them at that point.
Yeah, because they'll roll back the tape to when you walked in, and they won't connect. Oftentimes wouldn't connect, you know, because that's what they do, because most people don't leave multiple times. So they just roll back to when they got there.
Right, and now you're putting this security guy in a situation where maybe you're suspected of card counting. He's going to rewind the tape and look, and he sees you come in, and, oh, well, we only have two or three shoes worth of information on this guy, or whatever, you know, small amount of information it is. So they're not going to have enough data to make a confident decision. Now, you know, I think casinos make plenty of awful decisions all the time that aren't supported by data. But the point is, you want to always leave reasonable doubt for them. You know, put yourself in their shoes. What would make their job difficult? That's what you want to be doing.
Absolutely. And just another thing to add on to your concept of moving around a little bit is that just makes you look more like a regular degenerate, because that's what they do often. Sometimes they'll camp at a table too, but a lot of people move around from game to game.
Right.
You know, or, you know, when you do leave, just say, oh man, or like say a dealer gets tapped in or something, you say, oh man, I'm not lucky with that guy or whatever. Just, you know, ploppy it up and move on.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's this debate of maximizing versus optimizing. And mm-hmm. I kind of believe that both are right in certain situations. Like, you know, when you're driving on the highway and a guy speeds by you in the left lane going 90, you can usually speed up a little and you're not going to get pulled over, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're the guy in the left lane going 90, you got a target on your back. You're the guy that's going to get pulled over. So, you know, if you show up to a joint and there's somebody betting big money, can sit directly across from the pit from them, and you're just going to, the casino personnel are going to be watching him all night, and you're just going to see the backs of their heads while you're spreading, you know? Yeah,
exactly. Like that guy doing 90, if you're, say the speed limit's 65, 60, say 60, he's doing 90, you can safely do 70, 72, because, you know, the cop, if there is a cop ahead, he's going to pull that guy over, sure.
Right. Yeah, it's like the old saying, you don't have to outrun the bear, you just have to outrun your...
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Oh, it's all right. Yeah. That's my point with that, is just that if you shouldn't try to force things. You should show up and just see what the environment's like at the casino. Is there somebody betting money? Are you going to be betting the most money? Usually, if you're the person that's going to be putting down the most action, that's when you want to be playing shorter sessions and limiting your exposure the most. And then you're kind of waiting for those opportunities where, you know, there's a big whale or something and you can spread unabated. I remember one time in particular, you know, I'm sitting at this table spreading, spreading one hand of 50 to two hands of 500 at the time. And the table next to me, I started hearing some commotion. And so I'm waiting for a shuffle. I get up and go look at it. And this guy has just a pile of $1,000 chips in front of him. He probably had 60 or 70 grand. And he's playing on like an elevated stakes table, but it wasn't in the high limit still. And he's got a cocktail just behind him. There's three pit bosses in the pit talking to him. And this guy is also just drunk out of his mind. And so I'm talking to some other people that are watching, and I learned that this guy bought into the game for $1,000 and he just went on a sun run. You know, it was one of those nights where he was a ploppy, but he could not lose a hand. He was winning the side bets. He was getting blackjacks, winning all of his doubles, and he just kept increasing his bet and he kept winning. So it was just the classic sun run.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so he had run it up to 60 or 70,000, but now he's drunk out of his mind and he's just betting two hands of table max with maximum bets on the matches, and then like $100 chips for the dealer every single hand.
They loved him.
They loved him. And the pit boss are saying, sir, why don't we get you a private table?
Sorry, folks, we had a little bit of technical difficulties. The call was dropped, so we had to switch to another platform to pick up the rest of the interview. So we're going to pick this conversation right up. So sorry if it's not exactly at the same spot.
Yeah, so you know, that experience with that ploppy where he was winning 60, 70,000, there were two things that I learned from that, which was, you know, number one, the way that the casino treated him, it was 2 a.m. at this point. This guy was, he couldn't even stand. He was so drunk. There came a point where, you know, they're just feeding him drink after drink after drink. And he's just, you know, he's got that gaze, you know, when somebody, you know, somebody's blacked out, they have that gaze. He had that gaze and he has $70,000 in front of him. And, you know, they're trying to open a private table for him with higher limits. They're trying to do everything to get all this money back, because this wasn't like a big casino. It's, you know, his win was going to probably wipe out the weekend's profit. And so.
Yeah. And that shift manager, even though it's not his fault, is probably going to get his ass chewed.
Yeah. So, they were doing everything under the sun to take advantage of this guy, which, you know, really struck a chord with me as disgusting behavior. Because if they were classy or cared about this guy at all, they would have said, listen, let me get you a hotel room and a glass of water, and we'll color you up and come back tomorrow. You know, mm-hmm. if they cared about this guy at all, that's what they would have done. But they didn't really care about him at all. They just wanted to get all that money back. And so, you know, while all this was happening, I'm spreading on the other table. There comes a point where this guy, he wins an unlikely double down, and he jumps up out of his chair and throws his arms up in the air. And the cocktail waitress had been hawking this guy so closely that she was right there with a full tray of drink. As he burst out of his chair, and so the whole tray of drinks went flying through the air, and I'm on another table 8 feet away, and my leg got covered in a drink.
Wow.
And you know, so it's I ended up hitting the road shortly after that, but you know, I was definitely able to spread all night unabated that night because all the attention was on this other guy. And, right. you know, it kind of taught me that you just have to keep your eyes open as to like what's happening at a casino. Your goal shouldn't be to go in and like spread hard every single time, in my opinion. I think, you know, you're going to have times where conditions are ideal and you can generate a lot of EV, and you're going to have times where conditions aren't great and you need to settle for generating a little less EV, knowing that you can come back another day.
Or just move to another shop where maybe right. if you want higher EV.
Right. Yeah. And so that's where I fall on the maximize versus optimize debate is I try to do both when it's best to do so. You know, when the conditions are ideal, you get in there and you get some action down. And when the conditions aren't great, I try to promote longevity more than anything else.
For sure. And especially if another thing, consideration in that argument there is if you don't have many locals and you want to preserve a local for longer versus just burning it out in one or two sessions.
Right. Yeah. That's something I learned the hard way. I think I played rated at some local places and I was able to get several hundred hours in. I think ultimately I got backed off at those places because I was due to my lifetime win, because I was rat holing mm-hmm. chips and stuff, but it grew to like, I think at one place I was up almost 50,000, you know, betting red into green. So it's like, you know, at that point they can't ignore it. They just see when they swipe your card, like, why is this guy winning the more that he's playing? You know,
yeah, you were showing up on a spreadsheet.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, on the one hand, I think if most of your backoffs are coming from them examining your lifetime win, then you're probably doing things the right way. But on the other hand, you know, after that backoff happened, I went and looked at the value of all the comps that I had gotten, and it added up to about 5% of my net win. And so really it was like that for me was a really interesting point where I decided like, oh yeah, I'm not playing rated until it's, you know, there's a lot of value to saving your name mm-hmm. until it counts. You know, when you get comps, you want to be getting comped airfare, rooms, lots of free play, and, you know, comps in the thousands. That's when you want to be using it. You want to save it until, and I know a lot of people that are just starting out, they say, oh, well, you know, like spending $300 or $400 on expenses for a weekend is tough when you're only making maybe $20 or $30 an hour counting. And you have to come up with creative solutions. You know, maybe you go with some friends and they're partying for the weekend, but they're splitting the room cost with you. You're not partying. You're putting in some time at the table. You know, I think eating those expenses early on is worth it, because later on, if you're using your name when you're playing black chips, you're going to get some comps that are really skilled.
Yeah. I had that triggered a story for me. I had a situation where I used to play in this tournament, and this one place, this one of the floors at the casino ran the tournament, but he had an emergency. So last minute, the casino manager came down, who I didn't even know, never saw face to face, ran the tournament and was taking signups and whatever, cause it was like off the casino floor up in like a banquet room where they held the tournament. He saw my name. He goes, oh, I finally put the name with the face. I said, well, you know who I am? He said, oh yeah, yeah, I've seen you on spreadsheets. I'm like, oh. Yeah, and it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, it's like the ride's coming to end soon here.
Yeah, geez, it's yeah. You know, I mean, so if you're, you know, if you want to corrupt the data that they're getting on you as much as you can by rat holing or lying about your buy-in amounts, or, you know, oh, that person left with 10 blacks or whatever, you know, you sneak those things in whenever you can. But ultimately, if you're just winning a lot at a place, then yeah, they're gonna notice because they keep track of stuff.
Yep, that place. The reason I was playing rated there is because I played there for years before I was APing, like since like the late 90s.
Oh yeah, and so you were a preferred customer already.
So they already knew who I was anyway, and they gave good comps, and they were close to other places I played that weren't close to home, that, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours away, that I could get free hotel rooms and whatever. And yeah, so that's what I used that place as. But I was like, oh, he's like, yeah, so I mean, put a face with the name. I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, who are you again? Oh, I'm the casino manager. Oh. Anyway,
yeah, so you know, have any... You know, that your point about that interaction kind of made me think of, you know, when you get backed off, there's like a boilerplate statement a lot of places use, which is like, oh, you know, you're too good for us, or we can't take your action anymore. You can play any other game, but not blackjack, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so those are the ones that that are kind of forgettable. You know, you just pick up your chips and you leave. You try to avoid the cage and cash the chips at a later time if you can. Ideally, you don't even go back to your car if you can avoid it, because they'll get pictures of your car. But, you know, so the back-offs that deviated from that, for me, are the memorables. You know, so, like, certainly when you get trespassed, it's a much bigger deal. But, you know, I've had some interactions that weren't quite back-offs, but were just really weird. So, like, one time I'd been playing blackjack for a while, and this guy in a suit comes up to me and he says, hi, and he calls me by my name, and I was playing unrated, so red flag right there. How does he know? He calls me by my first name and he says, he introduces himself as the casino manager, and so I'm expecting this boilerplate line, right? But then the next thing he says is, I just wanted to let you know that we know you're on property and we're going to be watching you very closely. And if there's anything I can do to make your stay here better, please let me know. And I was just like, you know, this was not what I was expecting at all. And so I just said, okay, that's amazing. Thank you so much. And I'm going to get back to the game here. And so I went back to playing you know, really, I guess what that statement meant was this was a place that didn't back people off a lot. They'd countermeasure a lot. And so the next time I got a good count, the pit phone rang, and then they instructed the dealer to shuffle early. And so before long, I ended up having to leave anyway. But I was telling a friend about it afterwards, and he said, you know, the boss move at the time would have been to tell the guy, well, you know, you could get a round of drinks for my friends at the table here. I should have tried to get a little something out of it.
More sweet. Or a hooker? No, I'm kidding.
Well, I'm on the East Coast, so we don't have access to all the perks that the West does.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want that anyway. Just a joke. But yeah.
But yeah, so you remember the ones that kind of stick out, like that. You know, I think the backoffs from facial recognition are the ones that drive me nuts, you know, and you can tell when this happens because it's usually the same kind of unfolding of events. So I'll park my car in the parking lot. I'll walk into the casino. I'll sit down at a table and buy in. And then before the first hand is dealt, you know, they walk up and they call me by my name, even though I'm playing unrated. They say, you know, you know you're not allowed to play here. And the speed with which they're able to do it, it can only be from facial recognition. It's clearly not.
Or license plate recognition.
Or plate recognition, yeah.
More likely that, actually.
And I've had it happen in cases where I've never even been to the place before. And so they're clearly, you know, they have access to the databases and they're doing some facial recognition to recognize you quickly. And that's just maddening because it feels like a cheating almost. It's like, come on, you're supposed to watch me play for a while and decide whether you want to take my action.
I think the technology currently for license plate scanners is way ahead of facial recognition scanner. And I think like not having pictures on social media is a good way to not give them any more images of yourself. You know what I mean?
That's what they
search, the companies that make those databases. Obviously, I'm probably not telling you, then you don't know. But that's what they look for. And then they build a ID on you. But I definitely think that in my experience, the license plate scanners, I try not to park on property unless I'm going to play rated there anyway. They already know who I am.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of places, well, one of the nice things about our Discord that we have is, you know, we have intel on where the plate scanners are at several properties north. So we know, you know, which garages to avoid and where the choke points are and stuff, and we all share all that info with each other. You know, facial recognition is still in its infancy, I would say. It's very fraught with errors and requires a human operator to make, you know, decisions still. Because, you know, for most of the time, they're going to be getting matches that are like 60%, 70%. You know, maybe if it's a great match, it's a little over 80%. And they need a human operator to look at it and decide, you know, is this the person or not? And so they're still going to make bad calls.
Especially if you're a per- if I don't think either of us are, but a person of color, it makes way more errors because the way the software, maybe the software is biased towards fair skin.
It's just,
I'm not sure.
It arises naturally out of the fact it's for any minority, because the way that these algorithms work is they take in training data, so hundreds of thousands of images, and then they train the algorithm on those images, and then when it gets a new image, it uses that data set that it had before to decide, what's going on in the new image. And so if you just take a random sample from the population, then you're going to end up with minorities underrepresented in the data, which means that when the algorithm needs to make decisions on a new piece of information of somebody that's in a minority, it just has, not a lot of data to work with. So it is more error. So they end up having to overcorrect by introducing extra data into the system specifically for minorities so that the algorithm perform better.
So if you're a person of color, don't play in a Detroit casino because the data is probably going to fail. I don't know.
Yeah, there's probably a sliver of truth to that. It's, depending on where they're getting their data from, probably, some algorithms are better at it than others. So.
Right, sure. I just know I've heard of, not necessarily casinos, but like police, like law enforcement activities where they got the wrong Asian guy or the wrong black guy.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? And I've heard of, ZK and Stan the Caddy were on, in my podcast a couple months ago, and they backed ZK was telling a story. I think it was, telling a story how he was at a table and they backed the wrong Asian guy off, and he got another 15 minutes before they realized they got the wrong guy.
Yeah. I've heard stories like that from other people too that were African American, even that, they backed off three or four of the wrong people before they got to him. It's amazing the way this stuff can happen. And, it goes back, you can't underestimate the level of stupidity casinos will bring to the table.
Well, as much shit as people of color have to deal with racism-wise, yay for them to get a little racism working in their favor for once.
Yeah, right. They get a little extra EV boost.
Right. I don't think it makes the slate even, but hey, a win's a win.
Yep.
But anyway. Yeah. So speaking of backups, do you have any fun, entertaining, or just interesting or backup stories? Or everybody has a good backup story, right? If you've been doing this a while.
Yeah, I got some good ones. Let me think for a sec about which one to share.
You can just change the details to protect the innocent also.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's the one with the car. Sorry, I'm thinking out loud a little. You might have to edit this part.
That's fine, man. Do what you got to do.
I think my favorite back off that I've ever gotten, because it didn't even really rise to the level of a back off, but this lady came up to me and she said, I'm sorry, you can't play blackjack here anymore today. And as soon as I heard the word today, I was like, oh, interesting. Okay. And I said, okay. What does that mean exactly? And she said, well, you can't come back on the property for 24 hours. And I said, okay, great. I'll see you tomorrow. So that was, I shared that with some people, and they told me that on the casino side, that might actually be an escalation in terms of like, hey, we're kicking you out for a day. Next time it's going to be a trespass. But to me, it did not feel like an escalation. It felt like they were, really taking it easy on me by just disallowing me for 24 hours. So that one, surprised me more than anything.
She was making her job easy so she didn't have to do a full trespass. Just get rid of you and give you a hint that you weren't welcome there. But yeah, did you go back?
I did go back, yeah. And I played a couple hours the next day and didn't get a back off. I went in and I only played until I showed a max bet, and then I packed up, went to the next place because I had a loop I was going through.
Right. And you've been back there since then? Since that?
Yeah, I've been back several times. So that time was kind of a soft back off. I've been backed off there two or three other times. They're actually very polite there. They always use the boilerplate language and just say thank you and move on. And it is what it is. It's not very memorable there. They watch their games a little more closely than some places, and they just, they tell you you can't play and that's it. They're very polite about it, which I always appreciate. I like when places are just polite about it and they say it for what it is and they don't try to make something up.
Yeah, there's no reason on either side to be adversarial about it. I mean, it's just is what it is. It's a business decision. I get it.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of squirrely that we have the same business. We're doing the same thing they're doing. We're just taking a small edge and trying to let the math work out to make a profit. It's exactly what they do. That's their role. That's right. What they do. And
yeah, they could change the game so that counters wouldn't be a problem anymore, but it's in their best interest to offer a beatable game. And so part of doing that is they have to deal with people like us going in there to play it correctly.
And then here's another thing that I don't really understand. I'd say I don't quite know the exact numbers, but let's just guesstimate that maybe 10%, maybe that's even too high percentage of people who are actually counting are actually playing a winning game. So they should AP their back off, like really be strict. Some players let them play because that guy thinks he has an edge when he doesn't. So he's going to bring more money and bet more money than somebody who doesn't. You know, they're just a ploppy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I like to think of counting as it's got three, like being successful has three main components, and only one of them is your actual skills. You know, the second one's your money management, and the third one is your casino composure. And so, you know, you can be composed in the casino and be a perfect counter. And if you don't know how to manage your money, you could actually like be guaranteed to go broke and lose all your money to the house. And if they can recognize those people, it's in their interest to let them play and just blow themselves up, you know, because they're playing with too high an ROR. They're, you know, if they're betting like they have a $50,000 bankroll and they can kind of tell that he probably doesn't have a $50,000 bankroll, then it's probably in their interest to let him play. And you know, they mm-hmm. kind of have to take on a little bit of risk at that point. But it's definitely they're making out by having the reputation of blackjack being a beatable game be widespread.
Yeah, at some places they do exactly what we're talking about, but other places the minute they see your spread moving with the count, they 86 you right then and there. But they don't take all the things you just said in consideration. And then also maybe you're making a very small, maybe you're still playing a winning game, but you're not really killing them. But maybe your spouse is dropping a couple grand a night on the slot machines. You know what I mean? They need right. to take all that stuff into consideration.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and the places that back off or trespass super quick like that, I mean, chances are very low that they aren't doing that to people that don't deserve it pretty often. You know, imagine like your typical high roller that walks in, buys in for 4,000, and after a shoe, he's up 3,000. You know, if they're backing that guy off, they're missing out on a lot of money. They just, for whatever reason, have chosen to take the approach of like, oh, we're just going to, you know, back people off quickly and not think about it too much, which, I mean, it saves them time, I guess. But it's a costly decision, in my opinion. It's not how I would do things if I was in their place.
Yeah, this one place has this one pit that has a little short dice table, and then it has three card tables like a pyramid type shape next to the dice table. Across from the double deck table is some poker carnival game, and then next to that is a shoe game. So I was sitting at the double deck table one day, and like three suits come over. Like this guy, like in a really nice suit, comes over. He's like, I'm not sure what his title was, but he was up there. He's like watching this ploppy at my table is betting table max times two spots, most hands, and like watching for like 15 minutes. Meanwhile, 3 feet from the guy, this guy that was standing there watching this guy play, who was a ploppy, just being a ploppy, betting a lot of money, there's a guy actually moving his, I could see when the dealer would shuffle, I could see he'd go down the table minimum, and he had a big, he's betting five or 10, whatever the minimum, I think it was $10 minimum there. He had a stack of green, stack of black, and a stack of purple, but he's only betting $10.
Right.
That would go up. Right, like 3 feet away, the guy wasn't even, that guy was actually killing them. He was playing heads up on the shoe game, and the guy standing, the guy watching this other guy is all paranoid about the guy because he's betting to them big action. It's just so stupid. It's like,
it I'm is,
like,
yeah.
I could see it from 15 feet away. I can see what's going on.
Yeah. You know, they're working with incomplete, like a lot of these casino personnel, they know to look for the bet variation or big bets or whatever, but they don't know much more beyond that. And so when that's all you're working with, you're kind of feeling around in the dark a lot of the time, and they're going to make a lot of bad calls.
Yeah. A lot of places for some reason and think they really watch like their double deck or single deck game, but their shoe game, even if it's a good game, to, you know, by our standards, they just look at like, you can't beat that. You know?
Like, right.
It's so stupid. Yeah. Right under your nose. Yeah. I don't know. So I guess in that case, it's probably they were paranoid because it was a double deck game. I don't know.
Yeah, so that was probably my most pleasant back-off story. The nastiest one I went through, it was I played at this place for, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours over the course of the day. And at the end of the day, I had like, I don't know, $1,500 in chips left to cash. I'd cashed some smaller amounts. And so I'm looking to like go cash my chips and then go to my hotel room to like eat dinner, bed, so I could do it again the next day. Right. So it's kind of late at night. I'm kind of tired. I get in line at the cage. I get up to cash my chips. I hand him my chips. The phone rings in the cage and the lady says, "One moment." And my chips, mind you, are now behind the counter where I can't get them. She goes and I hear her pick up the phone. She says, "Hello." And then I hear her say, "Oh, really? Okay, I'll do that." And she hangs up and I'm like, this cannot be good. That was not a good reaction.
Right.
And so she stands like, you know, 2 feet away from the counter with her arms crossed behind her back. And I said, "Hey, can I get my money?" And she said, "One second. The floorman wanted to come talk to you." And I was like, "I don't see why that's necessary. I just gave you my chips. I just want the money." She said, "Just one second, sir." And so this guy shows up and he says, "Oh, you know, can I get your ID?" And I said, "Oh, no, you can't." And he said, "Well, you know, we need your ID to cash the chips." And I said, "That is not true. You don't need my ID to cash the chips at all." And he says, "Okay, let me see what I can do." So now he's bizarrely trying to act like he's on my side. So he gets on the phone and, the lady's still standing there. I just said to her, I said, "Hey, well, he's, you know, doing all this gibberish. Can you just give me my money so I can leave?" And she says, "I'm sorry, sir. I'm not allowed to." And so, you know, I'm actually a pretty even keeled person. I don't get bent out of shape easily. But this moment where they had my money held hostage and they weren't giving me my money or telling me what was going on, I started to get kind of angry. So I'm not one that lashes out when I get angry, but I raised my voice and I said, "Ma'am, you need to give me my money right now or I'm calling the gaming commission." And so as I raised my voice and said this to her, now all of a sudden the, you know, the Paw Patrol shows up and there's 4 security guards behind me.
Sorry.
So they, you know, the guy says to me, "Oh, is there a problem here, sir?" And I said, "There's absolutely a problem. I gave this lady some chips and they're not giving me money. I don't think they know how these transactions work."
Yeah, right.
So he turns to the cage and he says, "You know, can we give this guy his money?" And he says, "Oh, well, we need an ID." And I said, "They don't need an ID. I'm about to call gaming to get this all sorted out." And the guy says, "Okay, well, you know, if he says he needs your ID, then, you know, we're going to need your ID to cash these chips." And, I think at this point, a lot of people would have felt pressured, but I didn't feel pressured at all because I know these guys aren't police officers. And so I said, "Well, you know, I don't have to give you my ID because you're not a police officer. So with all due respect, I'd like to just get my money and leave." And so this goes back and forth. This whole ordeal lasted about 45 minutes. I was standing there's a line forming behind me at the cage. You know, there's 4 security guards. There's the lady behind the cashier, the cage waiting to give me my money. And there's 2 guys in suits walking around in the cage. Finally, they walk up and they say, "Okay, it looks like we don't need your ID unless the cash out's over $3,000. So you can give this gentleman his money." And so, you know, they finally hand me my money and I turned to the security guards and I just said, "Have a good night, gentlemen." I walked right out the door and left. And so, you know, that was a really unpleasant experience on multiple fronts. Like I said, I don't get bent out of shape easily, but I did not appreciate having my money taken hostage. I was about to call the gaming commission to come and get my chips cash because I wasn't really having it. I wasn't going to put up with that at all. And so, you know, before I left, they did inform me that I was no longer allowed on property. I haven't been back to that place, but it was a really unpleasant back off and really, you know, more than anything, just felt unnecessary to me. They did not need to do that. It was a relatively small amount of money. And, really they were just trying to trick me into giving them my ID. And I think they took it further with that than they even should have because 45 minutes is a long time. I mean,
yeah,
I had to really stand my ground and, you know, tell them that I wasn't giving them my ID I didn't try to say I don't have my ID, which a lot of times your best excuse is, "Yeah, I'll give you my ID. It's in my car. you know, pay, give me my money and then I'll go get it from my car and then you just leave, right? But I didn't even, I just said, you know, I have my ID and I'm not giving it to you because I don't need to and I value my privacy. So, you know, for whatever reason, that was the angle that I took that time. I've since found it's usually a lot easier to just say it's in your car. But.
Even better than in your car, because a lot of places, especially post-pandemic, they at least look at ID when you walk in the door, right? So right. The plausibility of you saying it is in your car is kind of out the window, if that is the case. Oh, I usually say something like, oh, man, I gave my girlfriend or my wife or whatever you want to say, my wallet. I'll go get it from her, you know, give me my chips and then just leave.
Yeah, but, that's a good one, too. Yeah.
You know, that way, because it's under, you know, she put it in her purse, you know, and she wanted some money. So I just said, here, take the wallet. I got chips, you know.
Yeah. And it's, you know, with these back off situations, it's you always want to make them not be memorable so that, you know, 6 months, 10 months go by. There's turnover at the casino. You can go back on a different shift and get more time in as long as you're not. So, you know, especially the first back offs people go through, I think you're going to learn some valuable lessons and you should always try to think back over the situation. What could you have done better? How could I have handled it better? Because it's kind of an ever evolving process of you want to always try to be improving in that category. And, you know, I heard this is a great example. I heard through the grapevine a story from a friend about, you know, someone he knew was counting in a casino in, I don't even know what state it was, honestly. But he's just sitting at the table spreading the count gets good. He raises his bet. And he said, you know, he saw a well-known card counter sit down at the table next to him and Wong into his shoe. And he said there was no doubt in his mind that it was him. And so the guy played two or three hands. And then the pit boss came up and saw him and said something to the effect of, like, do I know you from somewhere? And this guy, he just said, yup, and he picked up his chips and he walked out.
And like, yeah, <boss. laughs>
you know, there's a lot to be learned from that situation, you know? Like, you don't need to, like, engage in any conversation or do anything. Just, like, get out of there. Because they're not going to remember you at all the quicker you leave and the less you say. So.
Yep. I do that. There's a place in my area that's notorious for going straight to trespass. But they can't trespass you if they don't know who you are, or they can try, but. I mean, they can't mail you anything. They don't know your address. I don't park on property. And the minute I get demanded ID, you usually get anywhere from like an hour to 2 hours before like a bunch of, as you say, Paw Patrol come up and ask for ID, demanding ID, or sometimes the floor. I just grab my chips, don't say a word, walk out the door, leave, tell them I'm leaving. They ask you, are you going to cash out? Nope. They're like, really? I'm like, nope. And they're like, where are you parked? And I'm like, I Ubered here. And then but I'll just walk off the property and leave. The whole idea is to get out before they can get together and get their goons or the cops involved or anything like that. So
right.
Get off the property. There's no point. You know, don't be a jerk. But
yeah,
just,
you never want to escalate. You know, there's a couple of my early back offs, I would ask a question like, oh, did I do anything wrong?
Play dumb.
It's almost, yeah, you're kind of like instigating them at that point. It's like, I want you to tell me like how good I am when you're asking a question like that. I realize like, you know, there's no point in asking that. There's no point in like saying, oh, can I just play a little while? Like, you know, just say thank you and leave. And, you know, I had a back off kind of recently where I'd only been playing at this place for 45 minutes and I think I was up $32.50 when I got backed off. And so
wow.
these guys, they come up to me and they say, oh, you know, you're done with blackjack here for today. And I said, really, guys? And they said, yeah, you know, we let you play for a little while. You know, you're up a little bit, right? I was like, guys, I barely got enough to cover lunch. they were like, okay, well, you're done. And I said, okay, have a nice day, gentlemen. And that was the whole interaction. So
yeah, well, at least they bought you lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's something I always ask the question? I like it. It leads to good conversation. What's something that you learned in your AP life that transfers to your regular life?
I think, you know, discipline is a really big thing. You know, you learn to manage your money. You learn to, you know, you have to put in a lot of effort and time to learn, you know, card counting or various other strategies that you're employing. You know, if you're playing poker, you're probably reviewing hands and studying a lot as well. It requires a lot of discipline to get that practice time in. And then to play and also have a social life, you know, be there for major family events and stuff requires a lot of scheduling. So I think, you know, to operate at a high level just takes a lot of organization and discipline. And I think that a lot of that came from my experiences playing poker and blackjack. I learned a lot about how to do all of that. And that's definitely helped me in my career as well.
You mean your actual career that you have a degree for? Career, or you mean your AP career?
Yeah, my actual career. Yeah, I'm a manager at a software company.
Oh, okay. Yeah, definitely. I could see how those attributes could lead into that. So what's something that you wish you could have told your younger self that you think would be good advice for somebody else who's maybe just starting out now? What's something you wish somebody would have told you that you learned along the way?
I think the big one is just, how much your identity is worth. You know, it's really worth protecting that and saving it for the times where it matters. I wish that I had started out only playing unrated, never showing ID anywhere, so that I stayed out of databases a little bit longer. Because once you're in the databases, you know, your AP career isn't over or anything, but it's a constant thorn in your side, and it pops up, you know, constantly. It's just a new thing that you're dealing with all the time. And so the longer you can stay out of that, the better. And I think, you know, especially when you're red chipping, it's easy to fly under the radar if you're playing unrated and, you know, just get the hours in and let your bankroll grow organically. And eventually you'll move up to green chips and eventually to black chips, and then you can start playing rated and really, you know, getting the comps. So I wish I had told myself to not play rated.
And one thing I would say not to interrupt you, but the rated versus non-rated, especially like red chipping, is move around shifts and move around locations if you can where you're at. Don't like become a regular known guy, because then the idea that rated or unrated, it's kind of a misnomer, because you are still rated when you're unrated. You're just unrated. They still track your play. They just, they'll put a description in. And if they tie that description together, it's going to, you know, if you don't ever become a regular or known person, or they have a bunch of different descriptions, change your look, change your shift, play different spots, it makes especially when you're red chipping, it makes your longevity stretch out further. So I just wanted to add that on there, that they're still,
unrated players, and that
still
actually
get rated by the,
right. Yeah. And that actually reminds me of something else I would have told my younger self, which is spread my play out more, because I definitely focused my play on a couple places. And I wish that I had spread that play out more to take more advantage of exactly what you just said. You know, I think probably my first 700 or 800 hours were in two or three different casinos. You know, and eventually at the end of that, I got backed off at all of them, and I had made some money, but, you know, if I had taken the longer term view of spreading the play around, I might still be good in those places even today. So,
and they're probably close to locals or semi-locals, right? I'd guess. And so it'd be nice to have. They'd be nice to have.
Yeah, losing your locals is something that really sucks. It makes it that much harder to play. You have to travel further and further to get hours in. So,
well, fortunately for you and I both, we're in areas where good games aren't that far away. I mean,
right.
A couple, 3 hours, but, you know, drivable distance, even if you have a 9-to-5 on the side.
Right.
Or that's if you're just doing this on the side, you still, you know, you can manage a 3-4 hour drive. No problem. So, yeah. All right, man. Well, do you have anything else to add, or anything else you wanted to get out there, or anything like that?
There was one. So, you know, Stanford Wong has this book. I think it's called Blackjack Secrets, and it's it's a collection of just like random tidbits of information. It's a really good read, so I recommend it to anyone. It's kind of one of his more obscure books, I think.
Is it older? I'm not familiar with that.
It is relatively older, yeah. I can't remember the published date. But so there was one little tidbit in there that has always stuck in my mind, that it's kind of a cute tip. And for any red chippers, it's actually a relevant tip too. And that is that, you know, if you cap your bets with a pink chip being a $2.50 chip, you can actually get some free EV, because whenever you get a blackjack, the casino has to pay you $3.75, which they are unable to do. So they will usually round it to $4 and pay you the extra quarter. So most of the time, this does not really matter if you're playing for decent stakes. But if you're red chipping, it can be worth like an extra $1 an hour or so, just to cap your bets with a pink chip. So that was one thing I wrote down that I wanted to share.
Yeah, when you're red chipping, building the bankroll, that dollar an hour matters.
Right.
You know, you're red chipping. Just make sure they're not rounding down.
Right. Yeah, that would be a
sometimes
disaster.
I've seen that too. I'm sure you have too. But yeah, there's this one place that I'm familiar with that they round up blackjacks for the dealer, which is, I think, really cool. It's like, say you have a toke bet up for the dealer and you get a blackjack, they'll round up to the nearest whole dollar for the dealer, which is
nice.
Very generous for them.
Yeah.
Versus a lot of places round down for the dealer.
Yeah, that's messed up. That's penny pinching.
Isn't it? You're talking like 50 cents here and there. This one place rounds up. That's their policy. There was actually a dealer that was new there, and they were arguing with the floor, told him he was wrong. He's like, no, I'm doing this right. He's like, no, you round up for yourself. Like, what are you trying to do? Cost us all money. You know, they shared money, and the floor was a dual rate. He's like, what are you doing? No. And the dealer was new, and he was like thinking that he was like going to get in trouble for, you know, pinching an extra 50 cents.
Yeah, geez. Yeah. That's not a great work atmosphere.
Yeah, I know, right? But whatever. Anyway, man, so unless you got something else, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, I think that's all I can think of for today. Thanks a lot for having me. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, likewise.
Unfortunately, that's going to be all for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Waco Kid. I sure did, and we will see you down the fell.
Prison, I learned to count cards. What separates blackjack from other games is that it's based on dependent events, meaning past affects the probability in the future. The house has a 1.5% advantage. If a player knows the nature of the cards in the shoe, he can turn the house advantage to himself. To do this, he has to keep track of every card that is played. Count is based on a high-low system. High cards, 10, jack, queen, king, have a value of -1. If they are depleted, player's advantage goes down. The low cards, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, have a value of +1. The 7, 8, and 9 have no count value. Player keeps track of every card and calculates the running count. Then the player arrives at the true count, which is the running count divided by the decks remaining. For example, if the running count is +9 and there are 4.5 decks remaining, 9 over 4.5 gives you a true count of +2. As true count increases, the player's advantage increases. The idea is to bet little when you don't have the advantage, more when you do.